This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I think it's impossible to find a Mother's Day card that could come close to describing how you feel about your mother. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear some pretty complicated feelings expressed about mothers. Mothers who tried to save their children from trouble, and mothers who made trouble for their children. Mother's Day cards never praise the mother for being overprotective. Maybe it's just a difficult word to rhyme. Here's comic Jimmy Tingle on his mother. He was our guest in 1990.
I'm 8 years old, playing in the front yard. My mother comes running out of the house. Oswald's been shot! Oswald's been shot! Kids, get in the house! I could never figure that out. I mean, what was going through my mother's mind? What does she think, that Jack Ruby was sitting in a cell in Dallas, Texas, going, "All right, Oswald got Kennedy. I got Oswald. But there'll be no peace in this land until the Tingle kids are dead."
Did this actually happen to you, that your mother called you inside? And
right.
Was your mother protective? Did she not let you do things other kids' mothers let them do?
Oh, no. My mother was pretty cool, actually. She wasn't overly protective. No, I mean, you know, to a certain extent. You know, we had to come home, you know. You know, every night we had to be in, you know. Oh, real mama's boy. Ah, sleeping in your bed again, were you? Yeah. No, but she was cool. I mean, you know, I'm a pretty much the all-American boy, you know.
Comic Jimmy Tingle recorded in 1990. Paul Mazursky paid homage to his domineering mother in the film Next Stop Greenwich Village. Mazursky also directed An Unmarried Woman, Moscow on the Hudson, Down and Out in Beverly Hills, Moon Over Parador, and Enemies, a Love Story. In Next Stop Greenwich Village, the mother was played by Shelley Winters.
Did you have a Shelley Winters kind of mother?
I did.
Domineering
I did.
Mother?
I did. I had a very... I was thinking this morning, as a matter of fact, when I was sitting in a steam room in a hotel, of a book that I might write someday, because maybe the time is coming close. And I was thinking of chapters, and they would all be names of the people that were influential in my life. And the first one, of course, would be Jean, who was my mother.
I don't know if your mother's still alive, but...
No, she's not.
Did she live to see any of your movies?
She saw Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. She was at the opening in New York at the New York Film Festival.
Great, the one about sex, perfect.
The one about sex. And she sat there with me and Natalie Wood and my wife and Bob Culp and Elliot Gould and Diane Cannon and Mayor Lindsay. When it was over, she said to me, "Oh, so don't be such a big shot." That was my mother's, you know what I mean?
I sure do, yeah.
I mean, she was powerful and funny, and I had a lot of trouble with her. But she was definitely, I would guess, that, you know, the source of my pain and inspiration at the same time with the movies. But I now that it's all so many years ago, I think about it with great affection. At the time, I was afraid of her. I really was.
Was it hard to leave her and to go to the West Coast?
That was a relief.
Mm-hmm.
The West Coast was, oh, boy, I did it. I'm free. But she soon found her way out there.
Oh, really?
And then she said to me, "I don't like it. It's a lot of palm trees." And she went back. She didn't want to stay there.
Huh.
Director Paul Mazursky recorded in 1991. Everyone complains when they think their mother is overprotective, but of course we know mothers have good reason to worry about their children. Novelist Rob Forman Dew recently wrote a memoir called The Family Heart. She says that when she thinks her children may be in jeopardy, she turns to certain rituals and superstitions. So do some of her friends. For instance, one of her friends worries about her child traveling. So when her son is on a plane returning from a visit with his father on the opposite coast, here's what she does.
She scrubs her entire house, and I know just exactly she's...
What's the point of scrubbing
parent.
The house?
Well, if she has any fun while her children are in the air, I know she feels that somehow they'll take her children away from... that they will, the plane will crash, because how dare she have fun while her children are in jeopardy? Now, her children are getting older, too. All of us do this. I'm sort of starting to grow out of it.
What do you do?
Well, what I do is wear my opal earrings, which I have on right now, actually, because one of my children is traveling right now. They're really not even pretty, But my children gave, I was born in October, so opals are lucky for October. I mean, of course they're not lucky. It's a superstition, but, and of course I'm not superstitious, but I'm wearing these opals. I wear these whenever, I've sort of extended it now. It's not just my children. Anybody I love or care about who's traveling, I put on these opal earrings, which when a friend of mine recently flew to Australia, was really painful because they're not comfortable to sleep in. But they work. The planes haven't crashed. So I should knock wood now.
Right? So you have to sleep in them too, how to make this work.
Yes, you can't let yourself off the hook. If you're going to be superstitious, you've got to sort of follow through with it. But of course, I mean, we all know, all of the parents, my friend who's scrubbing her garbage cans with bleach knows that on some level, because she's a brilliant woman, she knows that that is not going to keep this plane in the air. But on the other hand, she's not going to take any chances.
Writer Rob Formandieu recorded last year. It's amazing what a mother can do to save a child in jeopardy. Writer Gary Paulson is best known for his adventure books for young people. A few years ago, we invited him to read a passage about his mother from his memoir, Eastern Sun, Winter Moon. This is about a traumatic experience from his childhood, and the language he uses reflects the fear and horror of the moment, so listener discretion is advised.
Mother and I spent the war years in Chicago. My father was on Patton staff and left with him in 1939, just after I was born, to train and then to fight in Africa and Europe, and I did not see him to know him again until I was 7 years old. Mother worked at a munitions factory on swing shift, where she ran a machine that made belted 20-millimeter ammunition. At first, when we went to Chicago and she worked, she would stay home on the weekends when she didn't have to be at the factory. We were alone a lot then, and she made me take naps in the afternoon with her, which I hated, but she made me take anyway. And on one afternoon, I was supposed to be napping. I found part of Mother I had never seen but would never forget. I'd grown some wile, even that young, and had devised a way to sneak off. I would pretend to go to sleep, lying next to her in the bed, and when I did that, she would doze off herself. These were warm summer afternoons in an unair-conditioned apartment, and the hot air off the street blew the cheap curtains in small puffs, and dozing came very naturally for her after the hard work of the week. As soon as I sensed her going to sleep, I would begin to slide toward the bottom of the bed an inch at a time until I made it to the foot of the bed and then carefully, so carefully, to the floor. Freedom. If I remained quiet, she might sleep for an hour or more, and I could play and enjoy myself. I didn't often do anything wrong. Played with toys on the kitchen floor where the pattern of the linoleum made lines that could become roads for my small metal cars and trucks and war toys, but sometimes rather other opportunities presented themselves. On one afternoon, I was successful and had begun to play when I saw that the apartment door was open a bit. I decided to go outside. I grabbed my stuffed dog with one eye and dragged it bumping down the back stairs and out into the alley. It was a wonderful, mysterious, and forbidden world, the alley. I was allowed to play outside only when supervised or when Mother was awake, and now I seemed to be off on some great adventure. Near the apartment was a billboard with a large pack of Lucky Strikes and the green pack facing out to the street. The billboard angled back toward the apartment, and where it ran into the wall, it made a hidden, darkened corner. I no sooner made the area next to the billboard when I had to pee, and I went back into the corner so nobody would see me. I set dog on the ground and was busy taking care of the problem when I sensed a dark shape looming in the opening between the billboard and wall and turned to see a man. He was huge and dark, ugly, and he smelled of old wine and vomit and urine with dirt grimed into his face so hard it seemed to crack when he smiled. Yellow teeth, all ugly, and I had fear so that my feet seemed riveted to the ground. "Well," he said, his smile widened, "fresh young meat." We were from a place where we did not understand such things as this man. Mother had once quietly, simply, told me never to take candy bars from strangers, but had never told me why. It seemed a very silly thing to tell me without a reason. But even with that ignorance, I knew that this man meant me harm, and I grabbed dog and tried to run past him. It was no good. With one hand, he clawed the back of my shirt and stopped me and lifted me off the ground, so close to his face that I could smell the stink of him even more, and with his other hand, he fumbled with his fly. "It's perfect," he said, "like Christmas, coming on you this way. Perfect." And I should have run or kicked or screamed or done something, anything, but all I could do was hang there in fear, still holding dog by one ear, hang like a mouse caught by a cat, waiting for something I couldn't understand to happen. Stunned into shock, waiting, hanging and waiting, and something hit the man so hard in the back of the head that snot sprayed out of his nose. "No!" My mother's voice exploded in the small area. Well, it was more than her voice. There was some wild thing in it, some snarling, ripping thing that made it powerful, all-powerful. And when she hit the man again in the back of his head, he dropped me. "Run," she yelled at me. "Run for the house." I took her at her word, but I only made the corner. There I stopped because a man and a woman, the people who lived in the apartment across from us, were coming to help. I turned then, knowing I was protected, but if anybody needed help, it was the man. He was on the ground, and Mother was kicking at him. "Not with him, you son of a bitch," she screamed. "Not with mine, you don't. Goddamn, goddamn, goddamn." And she kept kicking him, even when he was down. Not just wild kicks, but careful ones. She walked around him, waiting until she could find an uncovered spot, and then she would kick, hard and deep, in his groin, his back. And when he would move his hands to protect one area, she'd kick in another. And when at last his hands quit moving and he lay still, she aimed careful kicks at his temples. Aimed perfect, almost dainty kicks with the hard steel toe of her work shoes until he didn't move at all, and I looked up to see her eyes then. There was a great brilliant rawness in them, a wild anger and savagery that made my breath stop, and I felt sorry for the man without really knowing why. He could not win, could not live, could not be while she lived, and she could get to him. The man could not be. It was not that she was killing him, though she was, and not that he was being punished for what he had done or nearly done to me. It was that he could not be, could not exist. In her eyes, in her look, there was no room left for him in all the world. He would end. "You bastard," she said in a low voice, almost a hiss, kicking him carefully. He had by this time messed his pants, and the fresh smell of crap and piss filled a small space by the wall. "You son of a bitch, not him, not mine, you don't, not ever you don't, not ever with mine, you son of a bitch, son of a bitch, son of a bitch." And I think now he was dead. Looking back, that he was dead and gone. His head looked soft, pulpy, with spit coming out of his mouth, and the humanness was leaving him. But the couple who had come to help me took me away then so that I couldn't see anymore, took me back to our apartment. A short time later, Mother came back upstairs and sat with me in the kitchen chair next to the table with the oilcloth covered with blue leaves and cleaned her shoes with a damp rag from the sink, her fingers shaking. "You must never do that again," she said when she was done. And I cried because of what I had seen, not in the old man and his death, but in her eyes. Cried because it frightened me, and she held me while I cried it out. I was more afraid now than I had been while it was happening. What was that man going to do to me? But she didn't answer. She held me close and rocked back and forth while I cried, and then she made some Ovaltine, and I drank it while she went out in the hall to talk to some police who came to the door.
Writer Gary Paulson, reading from his memoir, Eastern Sun, Winter Moon. This is Fresh Air.